Drive Time on RTE Radio 1 with National Irish Bank. The bank that brought Danske Bank's international expertise to Ireland is now bringing the Danske Bank name.
8 minutes past five, you're listening to Drive Time with Philip Boucher-Hayes. 12 men and women have spent 17 hours trying to empty their minds of all of the furore and comment of recent years over Anglo-Irish Bank's involvement in the country's downfall and consider, did three men breach one specific part of the Companies Act or not? Section 60 of the Companies Act. It shall not be lawful for a company to give any financial assistance for the purpose of a purchase of shares in the company. Now, the culmination of the last 11 weeks boiled down to two questions which the jury had to answer without reasonable doubt. Did €619 million of loans to 10 businessmen breach that law? And if they did, did the men in the dock authorise or permit that scheme? Well, the jury has found Willie McAteer and Pat Whelan, the former directors of finance and lending respectively, did do that. I'm joined by Dermot MacDonald, the associate editor and legal editor at the Irish Independent, and by our own Fergal Keane. Fergal, to you first, the thornier task of taking us through the last 11 weeks of evidence, because obviously the jury found the evidence against these two men today more compelling than the case against Sean Fitzpatrick. Sum them up if you can.
Yes, Philip. Today was day 47 of this trial, and the difference really between the evidence against Sean Fitzpatrick and against Patrick Whelan and Willie McAteer is that Sean Fitzpatrick could only be tied into the mechanics of giving these loans to the Maple 10 borrowers through one phone call he is supposed to have had with David Drum, who is the former chief executive of the bank. The difference, Patrick Whelan, he went to places, he met with all these the 10 borrowers, wrote up the physical documents that they signed, handed them, got them to sign them along with David Drum. And then Willie McAteer, he attended a number of meetings. He was involved in the loan process as well. So they were tied in very closely to the lending process. Now, there were 16 charges today against these two men. The six charges that they gave loans to buy shares in the bank illegally to the Quinn family, they were found unanimously not guilty on all of those. But then they were found guilty of giving illegal loans totaling $450 million to the Maple 10. That's Brian O'Farrell, Gerard Conlon, Jerry Gannon, Jared Maguire, John McCabe, Joseph O'Reilly, Patrick Carney, Paddy McKillen, Seamus Ross and Sean Riley. And when you listened, we heard evidence from most of those 10 as the times went on. And some of them said some things more colourful than others, but they all did say that they were approached by the bank, approached by Patrick Whelan and David Drum, and asked to help the bank out in its hour of need. One of those, Gerard Maguire, he was approached in the south of France, in Nice, in fact, by David Drum and Pat Whelan. And he said in evidence that the bank asked for my assistance. They made money available so I could respond positively. And he said it was put to him that the bank was in difficulty. He said the bank had been involved with the business in the past, had helped him. He was going to help them now when they needed the help. And many others said the same thing. Jerry Gannon, big developer, he said he saw it as an investment opportunity. And many of these people, they were still stuck with these shares in this bank when all things went belly up and the bank was nationalised and we went through all the evidence of the fluctuation in the share value. But if essentially the evidence against them on the Maple 10 was that Patrick Whelan went, he had all these documents signed, he knew the nature of the loan from day one, the recourse, and so did Willie McAteer at one remove, in that he was involved in the mechanics of providing these loans and approving them back in Anglo-Irish headquarters in Dublin.
Dervil, did it prove pertinent at the end of the day what view the regulator or the Department of Finance or anybody else, what comfort they offered Anglo-Irish Bank in the operation of this scheme? Or was the prosecution case really just simply the law is the law here, regardless of what anybody says to you or any opinion they might offer on it?
Well, juries give verdicts, not reasons, and I suppose that it's only the domain of the jury as to what role, if any, those things played. They were told by the trial judge, Martin Nolan, in their charge that they were to ignore a number of issues, including any legal advice obtained by the bank. They were told to ignore the role of the regulator and of Morgan Stanley, the Stellar International Bank that had a role in the execution of this deal. I think a clue as to perhaps how they arrived at their verdicts split verdicts in one sense, because the accused, Pat Whelan and William McAteer, were found not guilty in respect of the Quinn loans, but guilty in respect of the Maple 10 loans. And if we go back and look at the five-step process that Judge Nolan offered them, he asked them, you know, to work out, what was there lending in this case? Was the lending issued for the overarching purpose of stabilising the price, the share price of Anglo Irish Bank? And then the key question he asked them was, what you have to decide, was this lending in the ordinary course of business? And again, without knowing what the jury thought, we only know their verdicts, we can kind of infer, I think, nonetheless, that they came to the view that, that the lending to the Quinns was commercial in one sense, that it was in the ordinary course of lending, or it could be classified as the ordinary course of lending, but that the lending to the Maple 10 was not. And I think that if that was the case, they, perhaps what were the issues that would have been relevant in this regard is the issue of recourse, because of course the loans to the Maple 10 were 25% recourse. I think that to what extent the role of the regulator, and the judge did form a view on that evidence, and any other party that the jury were told that on the law they had to exclude, I think that we may see in the forthcoming sentence hearings what impact that they may have had, not on the law, but potentially in sentencing.
Explain how it would have been a defence that this was not in the ordinary course of business, that this was extraordinary business.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think that some of the key things that the jury heard, which took this lending, the 45 million euro each, initially 60 million, but 45 million euro following further drops in Anglo share price. The prosecution had argued, look, this is not in the ordinary course of business, but just by the sheer scale of the lending. They also said it was not in the ordinary course of business, or couldn't be categorised as the ordinary course of business by virtue of the recourse. And in that respect, the evidence of Tom Reid, a former banker with Ulster Bank, who said that he believed, he was the only witness for the state, and he gave his view that the 25% recourse on the Maple 10 loans made them abnormal in his view. So I suppose a key question the jury had to weigh up in their five-step plan that was laid out for them by Judge Nolan was this in the ordinary course of business? And I suppose, you know, that when you look at the verdicts yesterday in respect of Sean Fitzpatrick, not guilty on all counts, I think what the verdicts have shown is a difference of opinion in relation to the role and the involvement of the three men in the deal. The deal itself wasn't disputed, Philip. I think it was admitted at the outset of the case that there was lending and lending for the purchase of the shares. But I think that in the following days, people will be looking at the difference between the three men that were tried in Dublin Circuit Criminal Court.
Fergal, take us through some of the differences there, because the state did suggest that there were, for each of the men, very different levels of involvement in the scheme.
Yeah, as I mentioned, Sean Fitzpatrick, he was the executive chairman, so he wasn't involved in the day-to-day running of the business, so he didn't sign off on this document. We are told by in evidence that there was no, we didn't hear an evidence of his personal involvement in the approval of these loans as time went on. Patrick Whelan, on the other hand, as I said, he travelled to these places, he met all of these people, got them signed off, and then Willie McAteer, he was back in headquarters, and it was his job to then sign off finally on all of these deals. But you know, now the trial is over, Philip, we can talk about a couple of things that we didn't and were not able to report on during the trial, some of the legal argument. And one of those, which I thought was quite interesting, is that the judge wouldn't allow any evidence about legal advice given to anybody, any of the three people, anybody in Anglo-Irish Bank, prior or after these loans went. We know there was a lot of legal discussion after the loans were approved. But then there was a legal discussion in the absence of the jury whether or not the advice should be used and should be given in front of the jury. That is the advice from.
And did you learn much about what that advice was and on what basis it said that the lawyers thought that this scheme was legal?
We didn't go into it in a huge detail into actually what the advice was, because there is a problem with legal advice in that it is a fiduciary relationship, but that is an absolutely secret relationship between the client and the solicitor, and only the client can break that level of trust. It's like a priest in a confession. In fact, it is exactly the same thing. However, we did hear from Paula Higgins one day in the legal argument. He stood up and he said, look, the bill for the legal bill for advice before this deal on the Maple 10 went through with €3,500, and it entailed verbal advice and one short letter. So when that's coming to a major bank from a very large legal firm, you'd have to think that there was no legal advice at all. So the question is, did they seek legal advice before the fact? Now, we know that there was a lot of legal advice after the fact, but that is really one pertinent issue which may come up in an appeal process that may be discussed during the sentencing hearing. And then another issue is, where was David Drum? He was a central character in this whole issue. He was the person who went with Pat Whelan to get this whole scheme signed off. It seemed to have been his brainchild. Why wasn't he here? Why hadn't he been extradited from the US to take part in this trial? And the reason being is that if somebody is to be extradited from one country to another, the crime must be a crime in both countries. And the situation is that giving loans to buy shares in your own company is not a crime in the US, so he couldn't be extradited on this charge and hasn't stood trial here on this.
Durville, sentencing, what precedents does Judge Nolan have to guide him here?
None, insofar as this was the first time that Section 60 of the Companies Act 1963 has been prosecuted in a criminal court context, although there have broadly been a number of what might be loosely described as white-collar cases that have come before the courts in recent years, including, although it was a very, very separate charge, the trial and conviction of former solicitor Thomas Byrne. But I suppose that really what happens now, it's up to 5 years is the penalty on the statute books following conviction. But it will be interesting to see, especially if Judge Nolan, who excluded issues such as the legal advice, and I should say that in the very early stages, the foothills of the trials, if you sat in just for the first week or two, what you would have heard before Judge Nolan's legal advice ruling was that the bank had received positive legal advice. We didn't get the exact details of it, but that the bank received positive legal advice. This was the testimony of several of the witnesses. But the case goes back to April 28th for the sentence hearing, and I suspect that given the uniqueness of both the prosecution and the convictions, I'm sure that there will be some very special pleadings when it comes to sentencing before Judge Nolan.
Durville MacDonald and Fergal Keane, thank you both very much.